Hi, Phil Hendry here, and welcome to A Phil Only, another podcast where we give the panel the day off, and I give you my thoughts on a variety of topics, hopefully things that are relative to your own life as well. And there's a couple of things that happened to me over this past weekend and a few things that I was privy to that I want to talk about. What is at the end of Deer Hunter? Remember in the movie Deer Hunter, where Robert De Niro's character goes back to Saigon to try to find his friend, played by Christopher Walken. And he meets with that degenerate Frenchman who's sitting there in a Renault Dauphine circa 1950-something, and he's got the bottle of champagne, and it's like this cat hangs out just to see the freaky side of life. And it's in the middle of the end. Vietnam is about to be subsumed, you know, by the North. South Vietnam is, and Saigon is in sort of a degenerated, that state that you often see societies degenerate into, where it's all just a bacchanal, you know. And they're in this fucking bizarre motherfucking world of guys playing Russian roulette for, you know, they're betting on these two dudes. And Walken's character becomes famous for this because he's able to survive. I'm not going to tell the whole movie, but there's a guy in this film at the end of this Frenchman with a glass of champagne. And he says, I'm interested in that which is exotic, the different thing, the exotic thing. Through the whole movie, through that entire part of it, you think, who the fuck is this cat? You know, what? But all he wants to do is further De Niro's, he wants to follow De Niro. He just sees this guy, he wants to follow him. He's watched this cat challenge his friend in this suicide game of chance, which is this Russian roulette. And he's become fascinated with this, so he follows. I think De Niro gets disgusted or something. I think he survives one round, or I don't know what happens, but I don't exactly know. But he was in there, and he sees De Niro, and he follows him out of the place and gets De Niro to jump into his fucking sports car, and off they ride, you know, into the night. And just this guy who is interested in any kind of weird scene. Now, I've always been fascinated with people like that, because that's not the first time I've seen that. I've seen it in real life. People who just hang on the edges of something fucking strange that's going on, and they're digging it, and they want to see more of it, and they want to encourage it, and they want to follow the participants where they're going. Man, there's all kinds of people in this world. Don't ever underestimate, and don't ever make the mistake of thinking that people are essentially good. Because that's not true. There are many good people, and I believe that the good people outweigh the bad, because I think society has advanced to a pretty good place. I do, even with all the horseshit, you know, we're looking at right now, but there are many bad people, but there are, I think, more of the so-called good, and you got to define what good and bad is. You know, what good is, whatever is sort of life-affirming, you know. Bad is what is life-destroying. I think that's a better way of looking at it, rather than saying, that was very good. Although saying, that was very life-affirming, Billy. That I cleaned up my bedroom? Yes. And I think, anyway, when I say that the world is full of bad people, it's filled with people who are abnormal. They're not sick. See, we get away with this thing. This is our thing in this world. Every time we see something evil or messed up or fucked up, we go, well, that person's, oh, they're sick. No, they're not. No, they're not. They're not sick. They're abnormal, but they're not sick. Sick is when you don't know where you are. Sick is not recognizing the reality that you're in. Sick is not communicating in the same reality that other people are in. That's sick. It's hallucinating. It's hearing voices. It's having multiple personalities. That's sick. You can't, in your worst possible frame of mind, a so-called good person, if you want, or a sane person, would never, ever, I don't believe, because I know it's true of me, and I think that I'm sane. I may not be all that normal, but I know I'm not bad. whatever that means to you. But I could very well be abnormal when I think this. And my thought is that someone who is guilty of a heinous crime, a murder, a vicious crime, but they're psychotic, I can't bring myself to believe that that person needs punishment. I don't care what the crime was. And there have been some horrible crime. Now, I know people will tell you, and it's probably true, and I have no reason to doubt this, that it's a very bad thing to consider all psychotic people are violent or these kinds of things. You're absolutely right. And it is probably a minuscule minority of psychotic people that would commit any kind of violent act. However, the fact of the matter remains that violent, vicious, murderous acts committed by psychotic people, however extreme, I can't bring myself to think that that person needs execution. And I think it tells me a lot about someone who says that they do. I mean, it tells me a couple of things. Number one, they're too stupid to get the facts as to what psychosis is, or they couldn't be bothered, which tells me that that person's abnormal. You know, two of the most unfortunate kinds of people to meet would be the psychotic person and the psychopath. And that happened at Columbine. That happened at Columbine. That happened between Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. Eric Harris was a psychopath. Eric Harris had daily fantasies of violence and sadism in his notebooks, in little journals that he kept. But he was able to con his parents into thinking he was just the sweetest kid in the block and he was a fantastic student. And this is true, you know. This is all borne out in a wonderful book called Columbine. Dave Cullen, outstanding. Just an outstanding book. And, you know, they don't talk to people like Dave or others that have actually really studied the problem enough. Every time something like this happens, and you'll notice that these things come in waves. Right now, we're so preoccupied with, you know, the current political scene in America. It just occurs to me that while we've got crazy violent things happening, I haven't heard about any massive school shootings. I could be wrong, but I don't think I've heard of any recently. In fact, not for a while, but I don't want to jinx anything, okay? I mean, there's no question, you know, that people are bumming right now about a lot of stuff. Yeah, I know some people are happy as pigs in slop, but the fact is the majority of Americans, or at least the majority of people that answer polling questions, aren't exactly too feeling too boogie-woogie these days about stuff. So, you know, there's only so much of this stuff we can take, right? And fortunately, we don't have to be inundated these days too much with a lot of these tales of violence and aberrant social behavior that have bedeviled us in the past. However, I'm getting way the hell off the point. The point is, when you put a psychopath and a psychotic person together, now you've got a bad cocktail there, man, for all kinds of mayhem, because the psychopath can easily manipulate the psychotic person. Easily. That's like, he's got a stick of dynamite there, man. All he needs to do is light the fuse. That's what Eric Harris did with Dylan Klebold, who could have been treated and could have probably survived to live a pretty normal life had he gotten to the doctor, had he been given the right meds, had he sort of been shepherded a little bit better. But I have to tell you something, man, you know, and I don't want to, you know, put it on anybody who may be listening, who knows the family, maybe members of the family listening, but there is a whole lot of parenting failure going on in that scene. You know, I don't give a shit what anybody tells you. I don't care how messed up a kid is. I don't care how psychopathic he is, like Eric Harris, who was able to con his parents. There were all kinds of red flags, one of which was a bust. I think they got arrested for breaking into a van or something. Anyway, that's abnormal. And then they're sick. So when you see a guy standing there on the edge of the Russian roulette festival that's going on, or you see a guy standing there on the edge of a fist fight or act of mayhem of some kind, or somebody being tortured or whatever, and he's just kind of hanging there on the edge, and it's interesting, isn't it? You know, it's not hard to identify someone as being sort of without emotion, and they're just mimicking people. That's what the psychopath or sociopath does. They mimic the behavior of humans so that they don't look too weird. They get it. They understand that they have a lot of instincts that go against what society expects. That's why they try to hide their behavior. That's why they try to blend in, you know. That's why they try to escape. That's why they try to cover up. They get it. They understand what they're doing is wrong, or what is considered wrong. They don't think it's wrong. As far as they're concerned, it's fantastic. This is what I meant. This is the most fun I've ever had, man. But this messed up, jacked up world that I live in, they won't let me do this stuff. So I gotta hide all this crap. So they pretend to act like a real human being. Have you ever seen somebody faint? I've seen this happen, so maybe I shouldn't. The instinct is to run over to them and to help them. I saw a videotape once of a woman fainting, and there was one guy who stood there staring at her and didn't move until he saw other people move. Now, you may say, well, he was shocked, he was stunned. No, I don't think so, because when he began to make his move, he was moving very slowly. He was holding a drink. He didn't put the drink down. He just kind of moved over toward her. And I looked at a guy there that seemed to me to be somebody who didn't quite understand what it was that was such a big deal about somebody collapsing and hitting the cement like this woman did, seemingly without consciousness. And then he saw all these people going to her, and something triggered in him. Something clicked. Oh, yeah, that's right. This is how... It sounds really almost phantasmic or fantastical, but it's true, you know, it does happen. They take psychopaths, and they've done these imaging tests, you know, where they have normal people, and they mix in a few psychopaths. I don't really, frankly, know whether they know what they got, but they will show pictures to these subjects while the brains are being imaged, and that is being scanned for activity. And an area of color, of red color in the brain, indicates a lot of activity. Now, there's a section of the brain, I believe it's toward the front, I'm not sure, that registers emotional response. And they showed these subjects pictures of children hurt in automobile accidents, dogs and cats being injured, pain, anguish, anything that would evoke the birth of a child, you know, anything that would evoke emotion. And most people had a fair amount of activity there in that emotional part of the brain. The psychopath, nothing. Absolutely nothing. What that guy will do is say, oh, isn't that wonderful? Look at that little baby. Isn't that great? You know, this is Now, on our Pete Bone show yesterday, I don't know if you remember, but Pete was talking about a dog jumping up on him and dirtying up his pants, dirtying up his $300 slacks. And so he had to have the dog shot. Now, fortunately, it's not a real story, so we can laugh. But that's taken from a real-life situation that actually he didn't have the dog shot, but... In a book I was reading on sociopathic people, they related the story of somebody who got really fucking upset with a dog jumping up on their pants to the point where they couldn't let it go, and they had a problem with the dog. And, you know, it was a real thing, you know. See, that's not a human being. That's somebody trying to mimic the behavior of a human being. If you're going to get really bent out of shape about a goddamn dog jumping on your pants, you're sort of giving yourself away. You know, you're really giving yourself away as abnormal among the normals. You know, I'm trying to think right now of any situation. If a dog jumps on me and I've got on a pair of pants, I don't blame the dog, man. I blame myself for putting myself in that. Holy Christ, there's a dog. Wait a minute. I got on a suit. I can't get a dog. Oh, okay. You've been there a million times. We all have. Wait a minute. Oh, there's a dog. Okay, hold on. Yeah, Jesus. And but a guy who doesn't get it about dogs doesn't get it about anything, because all he ever does is think about what he needs, what he wants, where he wants to go, who he wants to fuck with, who he wants to manipulate. That dude is only going to, you know, he won't be thinking about a dog jumping on him until the last second. And then it's going to be the dog's fault. You see that? That kind of thing is very weird. That's very weird. And everything in between, you know, all that narcissistic. People talk about narcissistic this and narcissistic that, being so into yourself. There is a difference between a narcissist and a psychopath. One of them can feel some emotion. The narcissist can. The other cannot feel any. All right, so I say all of that just to introduce you here to our second day. Is this a Coke? Thank God. Ah! You know, I don't know that I've ever addressed this in quite, you know, as direct a way as I should, but I'll take a shot. Now, I get this every so often, and I try to answer as best I can. But and I think it's a good question, and I think it's a good thing to talk about insofar as what Phil Henry used to do and what he does now. And that the question is following the following questions. How come you don't do the phone calls anymore like you did on your show before? Because if you haven't heard my show, my old show, what I used to do is play a character who was a guest of mine. So I was playing me and playing a character on the phone. And I affected these characters in such a way as to make people believe they were real. And people would actually call the show and engage these people in ridiculous conversations that we would continually amp up and amp up into insane satire. Give you an example of one. The most obvious one that comes to my mind is, speaking of psychopaths, Bobby Dooley said that she visited, Bobby Dooley's a character of mine, she visited Auschwitz with her husband Steve, and it was really interesting. It was really fascinating. And then we had a box lunch, and we got on the bus for the Bavarian Forest. So while she didn't overtly, there wasn't anything there that was wrong, it was dispassionate. It was cold. It was removed. It was, you know, you go to a place like Auschwitz, you're going to be in tears. A normal human being. Bobby is not, this character of mine. She's not. She is a psychopath. She, just in the tone of her voice, like this. Well, she evoked a lot of phone calls from people who were just outraged. And we amped the humor up to the very end. Now, that's satire. You know, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I goddamn sure know what it is, and I know how to do it. And I'm not necessarily saying I'm the greatest that ever lived. Although, well, point being, that's what that is. So people say, how come you don't do that anymore? And I answer the following way. I say, we live in an age now, probably because of guys like me, if not primarily because of me, we live in an age now where everyone is pranking everybody. Everybody is pulling a gag on everybody else. There are YouTube channels filled with clowns that go out and set up these kinds of, these faux situations that will, you know, prompt outrage or humor or whatever. This is the stock and trade of much of what passes for, you know, entertainment. Not all of it, but a lot of it. Talk radio, as a matter of fact, if you listen to it, you'll notice they don't take calls that much anymore. Here in LA, KFI, I don't think they take that many phone calls. And that's the reason. Because phone calls are just, they've gotten to be stale, I think is the best way of saying it. The phone calls calling from listeners are no longer earnest and honest, questioning phone calls from people who, you know, really want to get some news. No, because guys like Phil Henry came along and fucked with those people. Now the phone caller is on guard, and they're waiting to be jacked with. They're waiting to be messed with. They want to come in with their own little bit of shtick. They want to see if they can't one up the guy on the air. And that got to be sort of interesting, I guess, for about 5 minutes until it didn't work anymore. And finally, they just stopped taking phone calls altogether. The reason why I don't do my show is because the minute I got on the air doing a fake voice today, even if it sounded like a separate person, even if it sounded, which it probably would, to just even somebody had never heard of Phil Hendry, they would hear this and they'd hear these two guys talking. The first thing they'd think of, because of the premises that we used to use, would be, is this real? This isn't real. Now, one of the things about doing a show like that, you got to have great screening. And screeners of talk shows are not exactly the most, they're not the highest paid people in the world. My screeners were really loyal to me and to the show because they liked what we were doing and they really felt they were part of a real, artistic effort. But, you know, you don't always get that, especially when you're moving on to a new situation, a new station, new producers, new screeners. You know, you get all kinds of people with all kinds of attitudes, and you need to train them. You have to sit there and say, well, this is how you're really supposed to screen that phone call. And let me tell you what, you know, if you don't do it the right way, if you don't say the right thing, if you're not ever so gentle with how you communicate these things, then you got a screener that doesn't give a shit, and they'll just put any kind of phone call on the air, and then you are left to fend for yourself. So you're getting a lot of rotten calls. You may get one or two that are really good. You're trying to bail the show out as opposed to surfing the enormity of the humor, you know, which I don't even know what that would be. Surfing the enormity of the humor sounds good. Being on the air now, doing that show, would be impossible. It is my belief. Not only because the callers themselves would be a little bit more on guard as to what you're doing. Are you going to try it? Is he going to? Are you a shock jock? That's the other one. You know, that's the one that I got. Toward the end of our run on national radio, I would get, is this a shock jock? You know, or I would get that when I was doing a weekend show at KFI here in town. And even though you can create these scenarios and these premises and have people call in and take the quote-unquote, take the bait, right? You can do all of that. There's another balancing act that you have to do, which in these times would be even more difficult to do, and that is you got to drop the shoe, man. You got to let people know that they're listening to something that's funny. You got to let people know it's a comedy show. You got to let them know that it's a show, a satirical show, because I will tell you this. If they don't know, they're not going to listen. But if you let them know too much, you sort of let the unsuspecting callers in on it too, and you lose the caller base. So it's a real high wire act, and always was, you know, a real delicate balance. Now, my old, you know, caller-driven character show never had big breakout numbers, with rare exceptions. We had a few books at KFI that were really good, but and I remember when we were doing the show in Miami, we had great numbers. But on a national level, we never had big breakout numbers. We never had an easy time pulling advertisers, and we never had an easy time pulling affiliates. So that's there is. I'm giving you a little the true background of, you know, the reality of the show. People will say to me, "That was such a great show." Well, yeah, I mean, now, you know, now it is. Back then, we had a bitch of a time. That's the conversation I'm always having with people. It's a fascinating thing to look at, the history and the evolution of radio and then personality-driven talk radio and then news talk and what it became, right? You know, and what it's become. You know what talk radio has become. So anyway, I did this whole rap before. I don't want to do it again. Now, the summer is ahead of us. What I was planning on doing is getting in my car, and I saw an article once about the actor Anthony Hopkins. And I read this article, and I went, my God, there's somebody just like me out there, and it's Anthony Hopkins. And what I meant, what I, you know, was thinking was that he likes to get in his car and drive. This was an article I read, got to be 20 years ago now, that he loved to get in his car and drive. He lives in the States, at least he did then, and would get in his car and drive 10,000 damn miles in a matter of, you know, a couple of weeks or something. I don't know how long it would take you to drive 10,000. That's a lot of damn mileage. Maybe not quite that much, but he loved to just, and then he would stop at a hotel or a motel, and then he'd call his manager and go, guess where I am, you know, I don't know, Anthony. I'm in a place called Abilene, Texas, you know, something. It was fascinating for him. And I know that feeling because I love driving. It's relaxing for me. People say, would you like me to drive? No, I'm okay. I'd rather drive. Really? Yeah, I'd much rather drive. It's way more relaxing for me. I focus on something. I'm sort of in control of the car, which I guess there's, you know, says something about me, but I'm paying attention, but it doesn't necessitate a lot of physical exertion. There's things to do, but they're not too difficult. You can carry on a conversation. You know, it's an activity that, for some reason, I find to be very enjoyable, driving an automobile. And I like to drive them long distances, and I love going places I've never been, or maybe even places I have been. I don't care. One of the best things in the world that we have in California is we have this north-south axis. The state is on a north-south axis, so we can travel north or south, and we go through all kinds of different temperature zones and climates. We go from the desert, we go to the mountains, and you can do it all along the coast, too. And I'm not necessarily saying Pacific Coast Highway, although a lot of people say, that's a wonderful drive. Yeah, it's a beautiful drive, you know, but here's the problem with Pacific Coast Highway. Big, big problem. It's a very windy road, and there's lots and lots to see. There's lots to see. There's the crashing of the waves on the rocks. The beautiful trees, they're the meadows that you see. There's sometimes an occasional farmhouse or ranch house. Sometimes some wildlife. Beautiful bridges that span the rivers that funnel into the ocean there. And sometimes you even see dolphins, whales, you know. There's a lot to see, man, when you're doing the Pacific Coast Highway thing. There's only one problem with it. You're on a windy road, Jack, and if you're driving that car, you ain't going to be seeing a whole lot. Because your eyes are like, uh-huh. And you generally have somebody say, oh, look at that. The people in the car. Yeah, okay. But you can't really look at anything. I remember that vividly when I was taking a friend of mine up to Big Sur, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Which is one of my favorite places in the world. And I wanted her to see all of this. She's from back east. Never seen the California coast quite this way, and it is a beautiful drive. You know, somebody said to me once, it's a very dramatic, a friend of mine from back east said once, the Pacific Ocean is very dramatic. It's very, it was Yvonne, in fact, my girlfriend from Minnesota, she said it was like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. All the waves, she goes, look at all those dramatic waves, you know, this psh, like something out of the rolling of the credits in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. So that's not necessarily the drive I like. I like the 101. The 101 is perfect, man. The 5 goes up through the San Joaquin Valley. There's a lot of fog. But more to the point, it's just dull as hell. It's dull. It's flat farmland. Every now and again, you see a mountain. Every now and again, you see what? A billboard or something. There's a place everybody says, when you go up the 5, you got to stop at the ranch there. What's the name of that ranch? You guys know. It's a ranch, and they got an airstrip. And you have to stop at the ranch with the airstrip because they've got the blooming onion and they got hamburgers. Basically what it is it Haynes? Is that it? It's a place where there's an airstrip and they build a restaurant there. And it's right smack dab in the middle of California, right in the middle of between LA and San Francisco. So why the hell wouldn't you want to stop and, I don't know, get a Coke or something? Take a load off, you know, but you get out of the car and walk around a little bit. And so there's that. Other than that, you know, I can't think of anything else. Then you get to the back of the East Bay and you turn in. I don't dig that, so I like to do the 101. The 101's got the combination of a lot of sightseeing, but the road's straight enough, and I love doing that. So what I propose to a lot of my Backstage Pass subscribers is, and this would be very weird, but I would get in my car this summer and I would drive to different cities and visit my BSPs, wherever they are, right? In other words, I would go to them. We were thinking of a HendryCon where we would be, meeting at some damn hotel and having a huge-ass party and all that stuff. And I thought, okay, well, that's cool, but I got to, you know, rent the hotel and do all of that stuff. And it ain't cheap. And I don't really want that many people anyway, man. I'm only talking about hanging with, you know, at most, hanging with like 50 people. When you're hanging there with like a 500 people to 1,000 people, it's just work. It's really just work. And you're sort of just waiting for the end of the night, you know, and you can't possibly talk to everybody that is there to see you. Because I'm so massively popular. But I can handle like 50, 75 people. So what we're going to do this summer, I think, now, you know me, I get these ideas and I blurt them out and then I find out that I can't do them or somehow it's not going to be feasible or something. But I believe this is, we will just take a couple of towns a month, like beginning this month in June, although Maria's having her surgery, so that's probably going to be a little tough, and drive to them. Probably not drive, fly to a couple, but I feel the fantasy for me is to just drive, you know. Here I am, I just pulled into town, meet me here. I mean, it could get really weird. It could be very interesting. It could be a lot of things, you know. I'd have to bring along some just huge sumo security guy, you know, with me. Just, you know, because I don't want to get sued. You know, shaking somebody's hand too tough or something like that. But seriously, that's the idea. That's the dream. And I think what we have to do is, I think I actually asked people on a Backstage Pass chat one night to send us an email and tell us where you are. And, you know, where we get a good concentration of people, we will go wherever we get, you know, whoever has the most people, you know, wanting us to go there, we'll go there. And we'll kind of do that. You know, we'll just go from town to town. And what I ought to do is rent like a Model A truck and put furniture piled up on top of it and really look like a hillbilly. So that's one of the ideas for this coming summer. Now, I mentioned in June, this coming month, my ex-wife, my friend, my dear friend, a woman I love very much, Maria, is having hip replacement surgery. Now, she just graduated from Pepperdine University with her master's degree in clinical psychology. This is an amazing thing that she did. She, with this agonizing pain that at first she was told was bursitis and was given all kinds of stuff and it didn't help and it was getting worse. And, you know, you've probably been there. I have. There's nothing worse on God's earth when you're misdiagnosed and they're treating it for one thing and it's something else entirely. And as this condition worsened, she's dragging herself to the valley. She's going down to Malibu to Pepperdine. She's coming back up to Simi Valley to see clients because they're in a program where they are learning clinical psychology and they're also interning and they're helping and sort of interfacing with patients themselves. They're what they call clients. She's doing all this in a day. Some days are 12 hours long. She's got a dog she's got to get back to. I got to tell you something, and I've told her this. There's no way in hell I would have been able to do it. There's not a way in hell. And I guess that's the difference between me and, you know, somebody like, you know, Maria, who I told her, I said, I didn't think you had it in you. She goes, really? I said, I'm telling you, and I might as well be honest. I said, I did not think you had that in you to be able to do something like that. And so I have made myself available to help her in any way that I can. I mean, and I don't think it's such a great, I think it's something people say to me, gee, what a great guy you are. Hey, who's going to say no? Who's going to ignore that? That ain't great. To me, you have to do that. There's nothing great about that at all. I lived with a woman for 10 years. I admire the hell out of what she's doing. I can't imagine what her life is like having to struggle through this. She's on a walker now. This is a woman who is young. You know, to me, Maria looks young. She's 60, 61, something like that, but fact is, she is an athlete. Up until the point where she got felled by this thing, she was on regular walks and hikes, and she's played basketball. I told you she was a basketball player in college. She's been a runner. this is not someone who is a sedentary person. And now to see that beautiful girl on a walker is like too much, man. The good news is she's only a few weeks away, and by a few, I think she's only about 3 weeks now away from the surgery where she's going to have hip replacement. It's a hereditary thing. It's osteoarthritis that is genetic. So, and it will come on at this point in life, although there are some people who have had it in their 40s. And I think I mentioned we just went to the hospital where the surgery is going to be. I don't do a whole lot of medical talk, but it was interesting just listening to these doctors and these caregivers talking about how this stuff goes down. But I mean, on Friday night, we had a great dinner for her. Susan and Robert Ash, some friends of Maria's, hosted a dinner for her to celebrate her graduation. It was fantastic. We had a blast. I did my Facebook Live from there, which I don't know what I'm going to have. I think I actually looked at it. It wasn't, I looked at the replay. It wasn't bad, but there was no way in hell that I can sit there and it wound up, I think, being Robert, who's a terrific guy, talking to the audience himself about his crazy thoughts on life. And so that's one thing that took place. We had another, there was the week before, there was another little event for her. So now it's we're looking forward to her having a surgery and finally getting her ass back out on the road, man, and walking around like a regular person and not having to deal with this stuff. I can't even tell you. So that's why you guys, a lot of the stuff I am planning on doing here in the next few weeks maybe have to be moved around a little bit because we're helping Maria, you know. I got a cat, and I'm getting, the older I get, the weirder I get when it comes to animals. I feel like I want to adopt all the cats and dogs that I see. And so I understand people now who, I've always loved animals, but I've never been quite this much of a sap and a sucker for them. I got a cat. I got this cat from a friend of Lauren's. And the cat's name is Thunder. It's a black and white long-haired cat. And Lauren and I don't hang out together anymore, so Poncho doesn't come over here, which was her cat. And so suddenly Thunder hasn't got any cats around. Now, this is a cat that hung out with other cats and hung out with other dogs, as a matter of fact. This is a cat that has no problem, you know, hanging with dogs. And now all she's got is me. And man, I'm not a cat. I don't know what animal I resemble or act like, but it ain't a cat. And let's put it this way. I'm not out chasing rodents, not, you know, all the time. So I made the decision. I got to find a cat, another cat for her to hang out with, to be a cat with. Now, I told a story the other day about this possum. This goddamn possum that was in the backyard, and Thunder was back there, and I thought I was going to lose my cat to a possum. I went back there with a flashlight. I was trying to scare this possum off. This damn possum wouldn't. He got up in the fence, and he was kept walking away from me, but he was hanging around my house too much and too long, you know. Meanwhile, I'm listening to Thunder freaking out. Now, the reason why I bring that up is one night I went out there. I don't know, maybe she's making friends and I don't know it, but there was another cat out there, a big orange cat, big calico. Is that calico? No, it was a big tabby, right? But I didn't put this cat in with the vet to get all the shots and the leukemia shots and the this shot and that shot and all that crap just to have her hanging around with some slob alley cat, bunch of bums who probably haven't had their vaccines and are out there just spreading their disease and their degenerate lifestyles. Anyway, I got to find a cat for her to hang out with. But in the meantime, I'm going to go over to have dinner at Maria's tonight. And she's got a dog. This is a rescue dog of hers. This dog she found with a rescue place down in San Diego. The dog was loose on the streets of L.A. and San Diego for God knows how long. Who knows? When they found this animal, it was just living on its own. It had even had a litter of pups. And Maria took this dog in. Dog's name is Millie. She's cool. So I'm thinking I'm going to take the cat over there. It could be wrong. It could be a bad move. But this cat has been around dogs. And it's never freaked her out before. Now, if it turns out to be a disaster, if she starts clawing my face off, then what am I? I'm going to have to either put her in the car, which she ain't going to dig, or just take her back home, which, you know, cuts about 2 hours out of my day. Not really two, but it's probably about an hour and a half. Why am I telling you this? Just so you'll know that I don't have the easiest life. Now, the only other thing I want to tell you about is something that only I would consider. I'm not going to do it, but I'm always looking to have a major league experience for very little money. And of course, you can't really do that, but I'll keep trying. And how do I look for the major league experience? By first of all, looking at minor league events. And in this case, hockey. Now, the hockey season has come to an end, but next year, and Bakersfield is only 90 minutes away. Maybe it's about 2 hours away. Bakersfield is 2 hours away, and they've got a hockey team up there called the Bakersfield Condors. They're owned by the Edmonton Oilers. It's a hockey team. They play in a really nice little arena there, the Rabobank Arena, I think is what it's called. You've heard of this bank now, Rabo or Rabo Bank? It's everywhere. I thought it was some sort of a freak bank that that only, like, I don't know, Merchant Marines could use or something. But it's, anyway, this is the arena, and they're selling season tickets, and they're El Cheapo. It's a 10,000-seat arena, but they only get about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 fans a night. The only problem with teams like that is that they come and go. Minor league teams are always uprooting and moving to another city. This team, the Bakersfield Condors, used to be in Oklahoma City or something. And so that's what I was considering yesterday as I perused my entertainment options for the coming year. Hockey in Bakersfield. That's also the country music capital of California. Ha-ha! Now you're beginning to see the drift. Where else do they have hockey? In fact, where are they playing the Stanley Cup Finals? At least some of them? Some of the final games? Nashville! Who knew? Hockey and country music. They're both hard charging, hard partying, hard drinking, hard drugs. I'm joking. They're, you know, slamming their heads against the ball. All that hillbilly stuff. And you know what? I'll tell you, the other thing is, hockey players, Canadian hockey players, they're Canadian country boys. They're small town guys. Because Canada is nothing but small towns, with the exception of five or six fairly large cities. It's an enormous country with little dinky towns. And everybody from Canada, especially in sports, is from the sticks. And one time I was talking to a woman on the air, she was calling from Ontario, Canada, but she wasn't calling from Toronto. She was calling from way up north in Ontario, and she was talking like this. I might as well have been talking to somebody in County Meath. And I'm thinking, wow. And so I was talking to my producer at the time, Janice Ngaro, who's herself a Canadian from Vancouver, and I said, where was that? She goes, man, that's the sticks. That's way up in northern Ontario. That's in the backwoods up there. Now, please understand that, you know, we talk this way about rural Americans, too, you know, except the accent's different. But I say all that to say that, well, why wouldn't they like country music? And they got country music in Canada, Jack. Don't even worry about that. You know that. They got country and Northwestern up there. And I'm not talking Gordon Lightfoot either. I mean, I'm talking real hillbilly bands. And it reminded me of a quote of a guy who used to play for the Philadelphia Flyers, a hockey player by the name of Bobby Clark. Many of you who are hockey fans know the name Bobby Clark. It's a legendary name. Bobby Clark looked like a vampire because he was missing the front teeth. He loved to go out there on the ice and skate around with no teeth. They didn't wear helmets. So there's Bobby Clark with the hair flowing and the vampire face. And Bobby Clark was famous for many things. One of the things he was famous for was taking his stick in a grip they call a two-hander. where you're grabbing the stick with both hands at the end of it, and you slash down on a guy's ankle, or you slash down on someone's arm. It's illegal as hell, of course, but you can break somebody's ankle that way and put a big skater out of the game, which is exactly what Bobby Clark did in the Canada-Soviet Union series back in the early 70s when the Canadians were up against it. I mean, these are professional Canadian players going up against these army guys that they didn't know how good they were. It turned out they were damn good from Russia, from the Soviet Union, and their asses were in a sling, man. They were about to lose this series. The vaunted Canadians, the inventors of hockey, the holders of the Stanley Cup, the center of the hockey world, the no better player in the world than a Canadian hockey player, they were about to have their asses handed to them by the Soviet Union team. So they had to start playing North American hockey. They had to get out from the center of the ice, which is where the Russians had it. They liked the Russians were fast. They loved to pass. They loved to skate. It wasn't a game that the Canadians had ever seen played before, and they were not ready for it. Canadians played a physical game. North American hockey is a physical game. You play up against the boards. You freeze the puck. You know, you're banging each other for the puck. You play against the boards as much as you can. Slow the game down. That's what the Canadians had to do. The only way we're going to win this is if we turn this into our brand of hockey, and that's what they did. They began to force the Soviet players up against the boards, force them to battle for the pucks in the corner, all kinds of things, you know, freezing the puck, face-offs, slow it down. And when they slowed it down, they also could start to really jostle with them, hit, and unnerve the Soviet players. And they did. And one of the things they did, which was illegal as living hell, and I don't think Bobby Clark admitted to this until years later, but Clark skated down one of the top Russian players, or the Soviet players, I forget who it was, and with a two-hander, slashed down on this guy's ankle, broke his ankle, put him out of the series. Now, the Soviets were pissed. They knew exactly how that happened, why it happened. They knew it was intentional. They were pissed off, but there wasn't anything they could really do about it, because while you could probably throw Clark out of the game with a major penalty, you weren't going to get him out of the series, and you weren't really going to change the style of play, because it wasn't, that was illegal, but the physical style was not illegal. The Russians at one point wanted to pull the players off the ice. They didn't like the game that the Canadians were playing, but there was nothing the officials could do. And the Canadians hated the officials that had been employed for this series. A couple of them in particular. I mean, hated them to the point where, you guys know the name Parisi, the kid from Minnesota? His father played on the Canadian team. And at one point in one of the games, his old man made like he was going to beat this referee over the head with his stick. I mean, he approached him in a threatening manner with his stick, like he was gonna cut his head off with it. So Bobby Clark said the following thing. He said something along the lines of, "Well, if I didn't know how to lay a good two-hander on, I never would have gotten out of Flin Flon." Flin Flon is where he's from, and that's a town. And that's where he learned to play hockey. And that's why hockey and country music, it goes hand in hand. And what better way to end a conversation about ice hockey than surf music? So we've just come full circle, I guess, on something there. Thanks for listening to this, Phil Only. We'll be back with our panel tomorrow, Wednesday, here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show, executive produced by me, Phil Henry, for Siempre Incorporated, all rights reserved on Podcast One.